Major instrumento.
Yes, these mules have been supplying the battalion, and this chap lifted me up and put me on the back of the mule and said, I think it'll find its way home probably. And we had to go across a valley, and being shoaled all the way across this valley, but the old mule never murmured the whole way. I felt sure we were going to get hit, but we weren't, and arrived the other end, and somebody then seized me and took me off to the first aid place and dressing station, and that was that. It was the end of my active war, in fact.
Were you aware of what it was that had hit you?
Yeah, I was pretty well certain it was a mortar bomb, I think, in fact, with shrapnel in the legs, and it was a bit of a mortar bomb, or two bits of a mortar bomb hit me.
Were many of your comrades being hit?
Quite a few, yes. Quite a few were killed. And, you know, it's one of those things that happen. You don't really think about it too much at the time, I don't think it's... And then we had marvellous doctors in the parachute regiment, I must say, who did... they were absolutely marvellous in the first initial operations they did in out in the open very often. But I ended up in the parachute field ambulance, which was a bit further back, and operated on, and then moved down to a place called Bougie on the north coast of Tunisia, or Algeria rather. I think it's Algeria, I think, yes. And I was in hospital there for, I don't know, quite a long time anyway.
I know in February 1943 was the time when the Germans counterattacked at the Kasserine Pass.
That's
and
right.
Gave that was, the Americans a lot of trouble.
That's right, yeah. That was after that, after I was wounded. I remember thinking whether they were going to overrun the hospital I was in, you know, at the time. But I don't think I can like you any more than that, really.
You say that knocked you out of the war.
Well, I mean, it knocked me out of the active part of the war. I mean, as far as being an active soldier in a frontline unit, so to speak. But, no, I then had some convalescence in Algeria, and I went back to England in, I think it was July 1943. And I then took on this recruiting as a parachute regiment for a year, which was quite interesting.
What were you looking for, and how did you go about doing that job?
Well, we travelled the country, going round the training units, mainly infantry and gunner units, to get soldiers for the parachute battalions. And I went round with a doctor, a parachute regiment sergeant, and myself, and we had a film show to give them, and we took bits of equipment round with us and that sort of thing to show them, and they could volunteer on the spot, and the doctor was there to give them a preliminary examination as to whether they were fit, you know, and that sort of thing, and then later on they were, if they proved to be fit and so on, they were called up to go to the parachute regiment depot, which was that time at Hardwick in Hardwick Hall in Chesterfield in Derbyshire, and they went through their initial training then, if they were, and according to whether they passed their initial training, this was whether they were accepted for the regiment, and or if they didn't pass it, they were sent back to their units. That's how it worked, really.
What type of things were you looking for apart from fitness?
Well, fitness and leadership, really, too. I mean, because every soldier is a leader, really, in his heart. A lot of them turn out to be leaders too, very often when things happen. And self-confidence and And they went through it all right. You had quite a lot of casualties, in fact, in those days, because we used to do quite a lot of training with live ammunition. And you were, sometimes things went a bit wrong and you got a casualty. And there it was. But so they were... It gave you their idea of what their reactions would be under fire, you know, that sort of thing.
You were doing that job, it appears, from July 43 to November 44.
That's correct, I think, yes, that's right.
Do you have any VE Day or VJ Day memories?
Yes. I was in the parachute regiment had its depot, and well, not depot, but in training centre, infantry training centre in the Isle of Wight in Albany Barracks. The parachute regiment had its infantry training, so they called it Parachute Regiment ITC, in Albany Barracks in the Isle of Wight, which is now, I think, Albany Prison. And we were there. And I was commanding one of the training companies there by then. This was in, I'm talking about 1945 now, of course. And on BE Day, yes, we had terrific celebrations there. We knew it was coming, of course, and we made a few preparations for it. And there was general rejoicing everywhere, and we had a dance in the evening. And I remember it very well because I met my wife there. She was in the ATS time, and was in the medical centre, actually, at the barracks. One of the orderlies in the medical centre. That's how I met her. She had to be posted rather rapidly after that. But it was a bit awkward for a private in the ATS to be involved with a major. In those days, they wouldn't allow you to fraternise or anything like that. So she kindly got herself posted to Southampton, which wasn't too easy, too difficult from the Isle of Wight to meet up with her.
Because she'd met you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, we did it properly, you know, got it organised properly.
And VJ Day?
VJ Day, no, not really. I don't think I was... Where was I on VJ Day? I was on leave, probably. I was about to get married. And, yes, I got married in the beginning of September, that's right. And I was on leave, I think, then. Prior to going to India, in fact.
Did VJ Day mean as much to you as VE Day?
I don't suppose it did at that moment, probably, but I went to India. I'd been earmarked to go to Quetta, to the staff college at Quetta. And so I arrived in India just after the end of the war, really. And of course, everyone then sort of heard a lot about it. And I got quite involved with the Indian Airborne Division then, too. So I did hear a bit about it, yeah, and got involved in it a bit. But otherwise, I don't think... It was the Forgotten Army, you know, at that stage, I think, yeah.
Almost exactly 50 years ago, there was the 1945 general election.
That's right.
In which Labour got so many votes, and it's sometimes said that the army played a big part in registering their votes to give Labour such a big majority. Did you feel that yourself at the time?
I was in the Isle of Wight at the time when the actual general election happened. I remember being very surprised at the result, because I don't think people thought that Churchill was going to be sort of given a rather bloody nose, really, for just having virtually been the instigator of winning the war. And but I'm not so sure that a lot of the troops voted Labour. I may be wrong, but I didn't get that impression from them. They did register their vote, but I think a lot was said that it might have been the troops that were overseas that voted the Labour. I don't know.
Why should that have been the case?
Well, I think I'm talking about the Forgotten Army, the other end of the world. You know, there were a lot of British troops right there still. Remember, and I think they may have said, well, we'll leave the government in, but there it was.
Was there a sense that the country badly needed a change?
I suppose, I don't know, really. It, I don't recollect thinking that, but of course, it was a time when one suddenly changed from a war footing to going into a peace footing, and people may have thought, well, we need a new bit of new blood to do this, you know, but I don't think there's... I don't recollect ever feeling that myself, but...
Now, can we jump ahead to the Korean War?
Yeah.
And can you tell me how you came to go to that theatre phase?
Yes, I had just rejoined my regiment in England after leaving Egypt, having been on the staff there, and they were preparing to go to Korea. This was about October, I suppose, October, November 1952. And so I rejoined them at Pontefract in Yorkshire, where they were gathering together to go. And we then went from there to Liverpool and embarked in the troop ship Devonshire and went out to Korea by sea, arriving in November 1952 at Busan, and after that we moved up north towards the Imjin River and went into a sort of transit area to do some training, to get used to the environment of the country and that sort of thing, before taking over a position in the line in the Commonwealth Division.
What was your job in the battalion then?
I was a company commander in the battalion in C Company of the Duke of Wellington Regiment at the time. And it was very like 1418 war, really, because we were very much entrenched. I actually took over from an Australian company, and I well remember it because it was the day of the Melbourne Cup. And the only interest I could get out of the Australian company commander was he had his radio there and he was listening to the Melbourne Cup. and it was, as I say, very like the First World War, I think, dug in deep trenches and dugouts with probably 5 or 6 foot of earth or something above your head. There we were, sitting opposite the Chinese, or North Koreans, ostensibly, I suppose they were supposed to be, but they were really Chinese, I think. And our great object used to be to get a Chinese prisoner, and it was almost impossible to get one, because they either they just disappeared, or if you did get one, he would will himself to death. It was quite extraordinary. And I actually saw this happen. A perfectly fit chap, and within a few hours he was dead. How he did it, I don't know. But that was a very phony part of the war then. And then, of course, later on it all brewed up again, and the Chinese attacked us. But by then I had, in fact, left the battalion and gone to be the Commonwealth Division liaison officer with the American Corps headquarters. And,
did the Chinese POWs just refuse to eat and drink?
Well, that was the sort of thing, yes, but they had this extraordinary way of being able to will themselves to death. It was most extraordinary. But you hardly ever got a prisoner anyway, and your great thing if you did get a prisoner was to try and interrogate him and find things out. But
did you ever conduct any interrogation?
No, I didn't, no, that was all done by the experts.
How were the prisoners treated?
Oh, pretty well, I think, yes. Yeah. I never saw any maltreatment or anything. I think the British prisoners were not treated so well. They were brainwashed very badly. And I can come on to that a bit. When I was the Commonwealth Division at Corps headquarters, I went and represented the GOC of the Commonwealth Division, which was then General Mike West, at Panmunjom, where all the peace talks and everything went on, and this, of course, the war was still on. I went up there when they, in April, I think it was April 1953, when they did the first exchange of sick and wounded prisoners of war. And I was the only British officer at Panmunjom. And I had to stand with alongside a North Korean officer while we checked through the prisoners. And it was quite... incidentally, while I was doing that, the Americans, of course, had a tremendous sort of media radio business going on at Panmunjom, and I was suddenly called by one of the American commentators to... He said, can you give me a few... We're live to America. Can you come and give me a few minutes on the air to America in about 5 minutes' time? Which was quite an experience, because I didn't know what the hell I was going to say. I said, now, look here, you ask me questions, and I'll endeavour to answer them. And I did. I had about a minute and a half, I think, to talking to America, which I never heard anything more about it afterwards, so... But anyhow, I'm standing there, I say, with the communist North Korean officer checking through, and then I went back in an ambulance with some of the prisoners, British prisoners, and it was quite clear to me, going back in the ambulance, that they had been completely brainwashed from their conversation, and they were talking so enthusiastically about the Chinese, you know, and they really were. They'd been brainwashed then.
What type of complimentary things were they saying?
Well, I mean, I think they just thought we ought to seriously consider, you know, the Chinese point of view and all that sort of thing. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but it became very, very clear to me. And I think some of them didn't, but... and I think you probably... General Farrah Hockley probably has talked quite a lot about this, because he was actually a prisoner himself.
What physical condition were they in?
Oh, physical condition, they were okay. I said, obviously been looked after quite well. They hadn't been starved or anything like that. They were, oh no, they were okay. And I think they, you know, they were, there was no, they certainly weren't treated badly, but it was just purely the propaganda that had been pushed into them.
Were they all British or American?
No, the ones that came back with me are all British. All from the Gloucesters, virtually, most of them.
Did any of them complain about their treatment too?
No. No, I think they were glad to be back, but they, you know, they. I couldn't believe it that it could have happened. Just talking to them, coming back in the ambulance.
What were living conditions like for the Duke of Wellington troops in the trenches?
Oh, you soon learn to make yourself comfortable, I can tell you that. And, of course, it was very cold in the winter there. I mean, temperatures went down to as low, I remember the lowest I think it went to, was minus 26 Fahrenheit. And it's very cold. But we had very good sort of stoves for dealing with this in the trenches. They were mostly diesel ones, which, and you had a chimney that sort of went out through the roof of the thing, you know, that sort of thing. And it kept the place quite warm. In fact, you probably, when you went out of your dugout into the open in the cold weather, you probably dropped 100 degrees. In temperature. It was quite extraordinary. You could go out in shirt sleeves like this, like I am now at the moment, and you could feel quite all right for about half an hour, and then you start, if you hadn't done something about wrapping yourself up by then, you were very, very quickly, you were in a very bad way. Quite extraordinary. So, yeah. It's only one of those things you believe when you do it, you know. But it really was. The temperature was very low at times, and if you're careful, you get away with it all right.
What kind of food was there to sustain people?
The food was extremely good. They had very, very good rations in Korea. Quite different to the ones I can remember when we went to France in 1939. Very different indeed. And largely, I think, American, but on the other hand, there was quite a British sort of supplement to it as well. And we did very well indeed. Food was excellent. Certainly no complaints about that at all.
Did you have vermin or animal life in the trenches to contend with?
Not really. Time I was in the trenches, the weather was cold, and I don't suppose they lived really then. It's fairly healthy, you see. But later on, I think in the summer, it got very hot then, but I wasn't actually with the battalion then. I was with the corps headquarters, which was at a place called Weejeonbu. Called it headquarters, north of Seoul.
Were the South Koreans themselves providing any services?
Oh yes, you naturally got quite a lot of camp followers, I might call them, used to come and sort of work for nothing, actually, provided you fed them, really. And they were very useful, actually. They could help you quite a bit.
Doing what?
Washing and all that sort of thing, you know, washing clothes and all that sort of thing. And, of course, you'd find them, you're probably odd ones doing cooking for sergeants, that sort of thing, you know, particularly if you were out of the line.
Did the soldiers not pay them?
Did the soldiers...
not pay them?
Oh, I think they'd pay them in kind, really, I think.
Was the battalion taking casualties during that winter?
No, hardly at all. The odd one that might happen in a patrol or something like that, but very, very rare. I never went on a patrol myself as a company commander, no. No.
What level of rank would...
Mostly led by subalterns. The odd one led by a captain, perhaps, but...
Did the Chinese try to snatch British soldiers?
Yes, they did. They'd try and get them from the patrol, and it did happen occasionally, of course. But only I don't think we lost very much from patrolling at all. Nothing very much happened until the hook battle, really, from that point of view.
And you weren't in the hook battle?
I wasn't actually in the hook battle myself. I sat with the corps commander, actually, listening to it. He was terribly worried. He was quite extraordinary. He really was worried. I said, don't worry, it'll be all right.
Why should there have been the difference in opinion between the two of you?
Well, I think corps commander thought, well, I can only think he thought they were American troops, if they might have given in. I shouldn't say that, perhaps, but there we are. I'm sure that's what he thought, anyway.
The corps commander was American, wasn't he?
Yeah, yes. General Bruce Clark, he was at the time. Not Mark Clark, Bruce Clark. Mark Clark, I think, was in the Army Commander. But, and of course, I was being on the Corps headquarters there. It was very interesting because I found that no American staff officer could make a decision. Except perhaps the Chief of Staff could make one, but that was about the only person. And it was quite extraordinary. I remember with the corps commander sitting there with him one night, and I said something or other, I forget what it was, but he said, but you can't make decisions like that. I said, yes, I can. My divisional commander has given me authority to. You know, I found it very difficult to understand that you could never get an answer from anybody as a result about anything, because they couldn't make a decision.
Why do you think there was such a big difference between the British and American armies?
I don't know, really. But the Americans were coming round to us, I think, our way of life, I think, over that. I shared a tent with a U.S. Marine Corps colonel who had commanded a U.S. Marine battalion out there, so he knew what he was about, all right. And he said that the U.S. Marines definitely tried to copy the British way of dealing with things. And they did, there's no doubt about it. And because he reckoned they were... We knew how to do things. And it was interesting, that.
Any other memories from doing that liaison job?
Any other memories? Can you stop for a moment?
In such a mixed nationality corps, were any of the nationalities particularly outstanding as soldiers?
I can always remember that the Turkish were very, very good indeed. There's no question about that. Otherwise, I don't think we really came across anybody else, other than the Americans, of course.
What were the qualities of the Turks?
Well, very, very tough. I mean, they... And they were brave people, too, there's no doubt about that. But they were cruel, mark you. I remember one Turk telling me that he proved he got a... killed a Chinese by cutting his legs off and bringing the legs back. And that's the sort of people they were. But they're very well disciplined, mark you. They weren't... I'm not talking about ill discipline. I think they've always had a great name for being soldiers, the Turks. I mean, go back to Gallipoli. I mean,
how did you come to leave Korea?
I came back with the battalion when we left in 1953, and we went straight from Korea to Gibraltar as a battalion.
Were you glad to leave Korea or not?
Oh, I think a year was enough out there, yes. Mm. I don't think I was sorry to leave it. It had its moments, but... Well, didn't go. I mean, we did go on leave a bit and that sort of thing. I had had 5 days in Tokyo once from there, and had a few days on board a British aircraft carrier off the west coast of Korea as well, for sort of rest and recuperation, as they used to call it. But it was